You are listening to part two of our interview with Thurston County Superior Court Judge Sharonda Amamilo on the Women's Mosaic on KXRW FM.
I'm Elizabeth Madrigal.
And I'm Karen Morrison.
And we're the hosts of the Women's Mosaic, where the real lives of women and girls are shared and celebrated.
In this space, we honor the feminine and amplify the voices of women speaking their truth.
The Women's Mosaic delves into the real lives of local women through story-rich interviews, learning what works and what doesn't to enhance the health and well-being of women in our community.
We strive to share unique perspectives, resource sharing, and instructions on how to be kind by any means necessary. Welcome to the Women's Mosaic. Today we are joined by Thurston County Superior Court Judge Sharonda Amamilo, who serves the Family and Juvenile Court. Welcome to the show, Your Honor.
Thank you. I appreciate the welcome. I appreciate the pre-work that we did meeting one another, and I'm just so very glad to be here. Thank you.
We're thrilled to have you.
In juvenile cases that are criminal in nature, you are tasked with balancing accountability, punishment, and rehabilitation. Has this three-pronged approach produced any unexpected outcomes?
This was what I experienced as a juvenile, as an attorney representing juveniles. One of the unexpected outcomes is that parents can come to rely on the system to be an extra arm of their parenting as a fallback when they just feel really distressed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it's difficult for the juvenile justice system is that when you're holding a youth accountable or punishing them or rehabilitating them, they need the support of their family. They need the support of their parents. But if the parents believe that if you don't go to bed on time, or if you miss curfew, or, you know, you refuse to do the dishes, I'm going to call your probation counselor. Those are normal. Or you talk back too much, I'm going to call. If you weaponize the probation counselor, you're really making it more difficult for the system to help everyone learn to fall back on the natural support network, right, and put some balance back in where some balance is obviously lost, where the child is not showing respect for the parent, or the parent is not using the authority that they have because they fear maybe backlash from their child. So that's an unexpected outcome that I think has been something that we have really worked on. I know I worked on it as a litigator, and I work on it as an attorney. As a judge, I really talk to the children about owning, especially post-adjudication, right? In post-disposition, you've now either pled or been found guilty and you're moving forward, or you're in this alternative program, which I'm a big proponent of alternatives to, that can divert people off the path. But to just get them to own what they did. And another thing that we should be holding people accountable to no more than what is necessary to redirect the maladaptive behavior. So when it comes to that, I think when you're helping people build their own natural support network and you're trying to reset the imbalance that brought them into the courtroom in the first place, your child's out of control, so therefore, you know, let's try to help you. So I tend to focus on putting balance back into families so parents don't weaponize the court processes in the systems as part of an extra arm of parenting in their household.
Family law is significantly different from criminal and most civil law. So as family court matters generally are not focused on determining fault, how challenging is it to manage the interests of all parties?
Well, is that question designed to focus on family law with children involved?
Whatever, however mm-hmm. you want, however you heard it.
Regardless of whether children involved or not children involved, family law is so much about how people feel, right? And they are working towards a resolution. Mm-hmm. This is really where solving complex people problems comes like to fore every single day. First thing I say when I have a family law trial, whether it includes children or not, I am a stranger. And for whatever reason, your ability to resolve every issue and related to your dispute, you're unable to resolve some of them. So I want to know what you believe is in dispute. So I have one side go, and I have the other side go. And then we have a mutually agreed upon list of what's in dispute. We're trying to minimize the opportunity to get digs at each other and pokes at each other. So I have a reputation of not being drawn in.
Good for you.
I wish I could do that.
My colleagues say, we don't know how you do that. I'm like, because it's not my fight. I tell them I'm a stranger. And then after we have now we have an agreement in a room, right? We have an agreed upon set of factors of what's in dispute, right? After that, I tell them, I know you know their triggers and you know their triggers. And I'm going to ask you not to do that during these proceedings.
Absolutely.
So kind of lay down the expectations in the courtroom. Because I want to focus on the agreed upon matters in dispute, not anything else that detracts from my ability to make a good decision under the law. So going back to your question where it talks about not focused on determining fault, it's a big focus is the best interest standard, right? So it's a best interest standard. You have statutory criteria. The Court of Appeals has identified a list. So you look at those lists, and then the court is looking at what's in the best interest, what's feasible. And then the evidence standard is obviously different as well. It's the preponderance standard. It's a little more than 50%, right, you know, right. Where you're just trying to, what makes sense. So when people say, I feel like I'm being judged, you're not really. We completely suspend it. The role requires that you suspend your judgment and you listen. And then you let the natural folding of understanding with the guidance of the structure of the law, whatever the list says. And then you make your decision.
So I'm guessing this is not a job for a procrastinator who can't make decisions.
Well, we have a statute for that.
We have something for that, too.
Yes. Under Washington law, we are statutorily required at the end of a hearing to have a decision within 90 days. And the statute is very strict. The statute says, I don't know if this has happened to anyone or not. The statute says if you do not render a decision within 90 days of a hearing, you forfeit your position.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. The rights of an accused are embedded in the minds of most Americans, but the legal rights of victims are much less clear. How do you evaluate the voices of victims in your courtroom, and is that important?
Well, it's more about elevating their voice, right? And I don't even know if victims are told that the Washington State Constitution has a specific provision for their voice. There's a specific provision for victims' rights in the Constitution, the right to be heard, the right to be notified, the right to contribute to considerations for what the accountability is going to look like, what the rehabilitation is going to look like, what the punishment is going to look like. And then from the Constitution, the RCWs, the Revised Code of Washington Statute, also has very specific directions to the court for recognizing victims and making sure the voice is heard. When you have victims involved, The victim has to know that whatever it is you are meting out as a response to the behavior of the defendant, they have to know that that's going to keep them safe. You will hear victims say that sometimes they don't feel heard because they don't mm-hmm. believe that the outcome represents what needs to happen so they can feel safe. And sometimes you'll hear victims say the outcome was too much.
Mm-hmm.
That person is now going to be angrier. And when they get back into the community, and I don't feel safe. So that's why victim voices are so important to balance, you know, to kind of like measure against, I guess, what you're doing
right.
to make sure that it makes sense to the victim and it doesn't create a resentment in right. the defendant so that they then blame the victim even more. So it's important. I'd like to point out another point too. There's a crime victims fund. I have been told that it's underutilized. I don't know why it's underutilized. Things like the constitutional rights of victims and their access to crime victim funds, I think maybe the public needs to know more about those things.
Yes. Mm. Yes. You served as a military intelligence analyst. Has this experience impacted how you view domestic and sexual violence cases in which the perpetrators are veterans with PTSD diagnosis?
I don't know that it necessarily impacts how I view the case. So once the perpetrator has been deemed guilty, this background becomes relevant. It becomes, is there an opportunity for an alternative to incarceration mm-hmm. that is treatment-based, where it's partially in custody and partially out of custody? So that's where it comes into play at. I've been on the Washington State Sentencing Guidelines Commission by appointment of originally Governor Inslee and now the newest governor. But those are the types of things we look at. So the sentencing guidelines, whatever these crimes are, you know, these types of crimes, they have a sentencing range, low-end, high-end. It's going to be different for each person if they have a prior conviction, whether or not they have points, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not their low end starts here mm-hmm. or their low end starts there. But that piece is going to recognize whether or not there is a therapeutic approach that can facilitate them gaining behavioral tools that they can use to then avoid doing this again. There have been many cases where the victim's voice is nowhere to be found. I don't have a victim impact statement. Mm-hmm. The victim is not present. And I look directly at the state and I say, what is the victim's voice? And sometimes they've done their best to get the victims to provide a voice and they can't get the victim to provide a voice.
Wow.
Right? And so they've done their best. There have been other times where the victim has said, I don't want to put anything in writing and I don't want to be there in person. And I'm okay with the outcome. The Constitution requires the state to share the outcome or mm-hmm. any kind of plea mm-hmm. agreements and whatnot with the victim. And then there's been times where I've had victims in the courtrooms absolutely against a more punitive or harsher recommendation of the parties, an agreed recommendation of the parties, and wanting the court to do something even different, less harsh, but more therapeutic. In Thurston County, we have the Veterans Court, Veterans mm-hmm. Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Court. There are always dual diagnoses, almost always mm-hmm. there's some substances involved. And so there's an opportunity for them oftentimes to go to the therapeutic court with the felony of the other behavior hanging over their head if they're not successful in the therapeutic court. And there's a lot of support from victims for that kind of stepped approach.
We need that.
Yeah. I think that's, I don't know, victims are a lot kinder than you would expect in many cases.
I have seen that yeah. to mm-hmm. be true.
Yeah. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to Sharonda Amamilo about her work as a Thurston County Superior Court Judge in Family and Juvenile Court. We are going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation. From the highest mountain and valley low, we'll join together
with hearts of gold. KXRW programming like this is made possible with the support of the Columbian. I'm Will Campbell, and since 1920, my family has owned and operated the Columbian and ensured its award-winning news coverage. For the most thorough daily coverage of local news, national news, and local sports, both in print and online, and for subscription information, visit Columbian.com. That's columbian.com.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic provides evaluation and follow-up care for children and teens with orthopedic conditions, including sports-related injuries such as sprains and fractures. Care is available regardless of a family's ability to pay. The Vancouver Shriners Children Clinic is located at 900 Northeast 139th Street, Suite 204, and is open Monday through Friday. Information about services and scheduling is available at shrinerschildrens.org/Vancouver Clinic.
Thank you for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Thurston County Superior Court Judge Sharonda Amamilo, and our conversation with her continues. So state agencies providing child protection services have occasionally attempted to interpret the law rather than bring cases before a judge. How important is it that judges continue to exercise oversight of all these cases, and why?
I think that was the question of the year for 2025 mm-hmm. for Washington State and the wild child welfare world. I recently, as of September 2025, was appointed to the DCYF Oversight Board, and that board is codified in the statute as well, as part of an effort by the state legislature and the governor's office to ensure that there was someone who was watching or some entity watching over how DCYF carried out its efforts to best serve vulnerable families mm-hmm. and youth, and to include the Juvenile Rehabilitation Administration, the juvenile prison system. So back to your question, what we learned is that we were finding out that there were different stages in which they were bringing cases to the court. So sometimes a case would come to a court immediately. It would raise the alarm. Sometimes the case would be gone for 8 months. Sometimes the case would be gone for 2 years. And this was all subjective. The social workers determining whether or not a case meets the level of urgency to file a petition before the court. And so then this past summer, June, July timeframe, I think June, we had the ombudsman reported with a significant increase of death and significant incidents that raised the alarm. And so there was a lot of finger pointing mm-hmm. about the courts won't pick them up, or the courts won't sign the pickup orders, or, you know, just different things from one side. And the other side is like, what are you talking about? When we get a petition, it's been, you know, this dysfunction has been going on for 8 months under your watch. Right. We don't know what you're talking about. One of the things that I came out of there thinking, why don't we have a standard for when the agency must refer to court?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have a standard, why don't we have a standard? Is there something some additional support the agency needs to help the agency be more successful? Is it caseloads? Let's talk about what's going on. We spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 months finger pointing when we should have just all been at the table. Every entity, every stakeholder from everywhere in the state, foster care, the folks in foster care, the folks in victims advocates, mm-hmm. children, everybody should have been at the table talking about what happened. And can we establish some sort of standard? Right, right. We lost time pointing a finger about whose fault it was. Mm-hmm. That was concerning to me. We have a very robust system of training for your judges here in Washington State at the Superior Court level. That's who's doing this work. And we have a much more uniform way to build safe systems and safe networks for children and vulnerable families.
True.
Versus social workers who there did not appear to be a uniform when, what, where, and how, way in which a case would be brought before a court.
Before a perpetrator is sentenced, the court offers an opportunity to speak to advocate for themselves. Even if a perpetrator waives this right, are there any questions you will ask them?
Yes. And this came from a judicial training. And the question is, what happened to you? You might not have questions for me, and I appreciate that. And, you know, this is a lot, and I appreciate how it may be difficult. But I have a question for you. What happened to you? That question does open people up. The response of a then 20-year-old who, when I asked her that question, her answer was, because I was born with a DOC number on my back, Your Honor. And the room went silent.
And by, if you can explain what a DOC number is.
Yes. A DOC number is your identification in the Washington Department of Corrections if you are an inmate and or resident of one of their institutions. And this 20-year-old was born in prison. While her mom was in prison, and she got to live in prison with her mom until she was the maximum age they allowed the toddlers to leave. And but nobody knew that, and nobody was going to tell me that when I'm sentencing a 20-year-old with maximum points. And so I asked that first question, and then I said, what do you mean? And then she told me the story about her being born in prison, and how her and her mother, when they were released from prison, there were some support services, but not a lot, maybe birth to three. And they moved in with her mom's grandma. So they moved in with a great grandma who was already elderly and had some medical things going on. And apparently mom never really got on her feet, because by the time the 20-year-old was, what she explained to court, she was 15, grandma died and mom couldn't keep the house. And so she said, I was 17 years old and homeless with a backpack and a bicycle. And I had to survive.
Wow.
And so she, between eight, she had juvenile ins and outs. But then by the time she was 18, she had maxed out. Max is 9 points in Washington. That's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot. And she had maxed out at 20. I said, how did you max out at 20? And they had come in with a recommendation that I just was not going to ignore this background. And I had the discretion to do that. I can't go below the minimums, but I certainly wasn't going to give her the highest when she didn't have school support. She didn't have community support. She had nothing to help her avoid that outcome.
Right.
So taking that into consideration, I became extremely concerned about mothers and their babies being released into all 39 counties of Washington State, and whether or not they had a robust enough system to surround them. And I am working with a group of treatment providers and community leaders. Just to start to focus on women being released into Thurston County with their babies, right, to make sure they have robust wraparound when they're released. Because I shouldn't have learned that by asking. That should have been part of some sort of mitigation for me to understand what was impacting some of that behavior. But if you don't ask that question and know and want to know,
right,
then you would never learn that a newborn had a DOC number on her back when she was born.
It's horrifying, really. It's heartbreaking, actually, more than horrifying. It's heartbreaking.
But those are the type of catalysts, right, for me, that I can work within the system to help make the system better for victims, defendants, families, and newborns. Right?
Oh,
it's
wow.
important to...
Right.
Before we go, is there anything we haven't asked you that you would like to share?
I think it's important that people know that a person like me and my background is running for the Washington Supreme Court. My website is sharondafforjustice.org. And if you go there, you will see that a lot of what we're talking about is that I live a very intentional and purposeful life, and I bring that to the seriousness of the work that we're doing in the courtrooms every day. Everybody walking to that courtroom every day is there because they think that's the most important thing for them to be doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have respect for that, right? Yes. You got to have respect for the complexity of the litigants, the complexity of the professionals, the complexity of the staff, you know. And if someone comes in the courtroom and they're having a bad day and you know you had nothing to do with it, why would you become offended? Even if they're directing it at you, why are you going to become offended? If something doesn't rise to a level of a safety issue, then what you want to get to is you seem to be very upset about something. Let's see if we can address that quickly. If we can, great. If we can't, we acknowledge it and we try to get to the business of what's in front of the court. And what's in front of the court is people's lives, people's property, mm-hmm. people's rights. You know, all of those things are in front of the court. And as a judicial officer, you can't take the humanity out of the law.
That's right.
You have to marry those things together.
Right.
In a way that shows respect for the law. Right. I think it's important to always be clear. So, and that's the thing that the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court writes decisions, no matter if it's an environmental decision or a tax decision, or whether or not a termination of parental rights was correct, or whether or not the sovereignty of a tribal nation was respected. The Supreme Court's job is to write very clear rulings and opinions so that the trial court knows what to do, right. and it's uniform across the whole state. I think that's extremely exciting.
Yes.
It's very important, and I would welcome any of your votes.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Judge Amamilo. It has been an honor to speak with you today, and we're very, very excited. Very excited that you're a public servant and that you are, you know, wanting to serve at a higher level. So good luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. This was very enjoyable. I could talk for 2 or 3 more hours with you all. You're so comfortable.
Oh, we love talking
to
each other and to other people who are an inspiration like you are. Changing the world for good.
Thank you.
For more information about the work Judge Sharonda Amamilo is doing in the Family and Juvenile Court, please click on Thurston County Superior Court on the website thurstoncountywa.gov.
This concludes the second part of our interview with Superior Court Judge Sharonda Amamilo. If you'd like to hear part one of this interview, visit kxrw.fm and click on the Women's Mosaic show page where you'll find the streaming link. And that's our show. New episodes broadcast on the second and fourth Tuesdays, but you can stream any episode online anytime.
We are so grateful to our guests for sharing their knowledge and life experiences with us in their support of the health and well-being of women and girls.
So until next time, be kind by any means necessary.
And remember to honor your power.